It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 92, An American in Paris. An American in Paris is a 1951 film directed by Vincente Minnelli, starring Gene Kelly, Leslie Caron, and some other people. And speaking of other people, let me introduce you to my two panelists who are already doing impressions. You'll hear those later. First up, Mickey Maynard. Hello.
Hello, Shelley. You can take me to lunch.
All right, I'll put that on my calendar. Also here, David J. Lohr. Hiya.
To quote Michael Palin as Cardinal Richelieu, mais oui.
I did not work on my French for this episode. Perhaps I should have.
American. Yeah, we got you covered.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
We got all the French you need.
I'm playing straight person in this show, and I think that's probably best for everyone. Well, let us get started in the usual way here on Lions, Towers, and Shields. I want to know from each of you what your experience with this movie is. Knowing you to be movie raconteurs as I do, I'm sure you've seen this before. But David, how many times have you seen American in Paris?
Oh, I have no idea. It's just way too many times. It's maybe... Well, I go back and forth between this and Singin' in the Rain as my favorite movie of the Freed unit at MGM. I think it's this just because I love Gershwin and I really don't care about most of the songs in Singin' in the Rain. So, you know, having grown up with a Gershwin fan, I mean, like a super Gershwin fan, the music was ever present as far back as I can remember. Like my earliest memories are probably Star Trek, Gershwin, Cole Porter, right? That's just the fabric of my life. And so once, you know, it was a special thing when it would show up on TV in syndication, but once you had it on demand, you know, once it was released to home video, we had a copy and we watched it regularly. And then when it was on a new type of home video edition, boom, there we had that so that the tape didn't snap. I've seen it a lot.
Yeah, it's one of those that has been in very wide circulation. Some of the musicals from MGM in the 40s and 50s are more easy to see than others, and I've always felt like this one is very easy to see if you just happen to be tuning around, but also if you want to see it on purpose. It's been available in many formats over many years. Mickey, how about you?
Being a best picture, too.
Yes.
That's got to help.
Yes, we were going to get to that. It's been nominated for and won a boatload of Oscars. I don't know that we've talked about a movie that's won as many awards as this one has, which is really interesting, given I'm going to make some parallels to Singing in the Rain a little bit later, which I didn't even think about until I was looking at how many Oscars this movie had won. And Singing in the Rain, spoiler alert, did not win so many. Mickey Maynard, what is your background with this movie?
Well, Gene Kelly is my earliest celebrity crush. I saw him in Anchors Away with the Mouse and Frank Sinatra and fell deeply in love for my entire life. I rode away for an autographed picture of Gene Kelly, and Gene Kelly sent me an autographed picture. This movie, I don't think I saw it until I was maybe a teenager. I don't think it played in rotation on a lot of the stations that carried movies. I almost think it was one of those NBC movie of the week or something like that. But I later bought it on VHS. So I had a tape of it and then a DVD of it. And it's one of those movies when it's on, and if I'm not doing anything else, I'll drop in and watch it for a little while.
Well, it is appropriate that you mention your crush on Gene Kelly, because the inspiration for this movie, which perhaps both of you remember, but the audience might not, the inspiration for us discussing this movie goes back to the draft that we did at the end of 2022, choosing a bunch of movies or people that we liked in classic Hollywood. And one of our panelists, who I was really expecting to join us tonight, and he didn't, drafted Gene Kelly's butt. Because there is a Tumblr out there that celebrates the beauty that is Gene Kelly's butt, and the top image is from this movie. And so it is the quintessential Gene Kelly's butt, although you can see it in many places. And the scene it references is one where he's wearing, you know, light, tight clothing that accentuates his butt to a great degree.
I mean, it is it is never not bad. Not that I've ever had a crush or swing that way even slightly, but it's never not bad.
But.
Maybe in Xanadu, but you know, but this is primo.
I blocked that out of my mind, but
you get the opportunity to see many forms of Gene Kelly's butt in this movie. Mm-hmm. So the scene you're referring to is when he's dressed as a jockey. And that was what jockeys wore in 1900 or whenever Toulouse-Lautrec was painting jockeys. And then there's his butt in khakis and his butt in evening clothes. And so it's a feast of butts.
And he's got a great baseball cap.
Yes.
I want that cap. I have an early Banana Republic back when they were cool, before the Gap bought them. I've got a Banana Republic cap that is very similar to that ball cap.
Still in good shape.
Oh, yes.
Well, this movie, as David alluded to, was part of the Freed Unit at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. I think of the Metro musicals as in two real important eras, basically the 40s and the 50s. And we're at the beginning of the 50s. It's still the Freed Unit. Freed would not be producing musicals at MGM the entire time. He was more of a 40s producer. He was famously Judy Garland's producer, did a lot of other musicals. But we're in the era of bigger musicals, more splashy musicals. They did. This movie was not done on location. This is very much a studio movie, but it still has the look of something with more sort of visual ambition than some of the ones the Let's Put On a Show movies that were in the 40s that were just all backlot all the time. And then we're going to get, you know, later on into bigger spectacle movies, more Technicolor, that kind of thing. So it feels like it's the dawn of this era. And the other thing, as I alluded to earlier, was the comparison between this movie and Singing in the Rain, which comes out a year later, is interesting because Singing in the Rain kind of is better known now. If you said name a Gene Kelly movie, I'm sure 90% of the people you asked would name Singing in the Rain, and probably have a bunch of them have seen it, whereas a lot of people have not seen this one. And but yet this one, and it came out first, so I guess that has something to do with it. It won a boatload of Oscars. It was well regarded at the time. It was well reviewed. Singing in the Rain, I think, was too. But this movie seems to have a more sort of serious reputation, I guess, at least in the time that it was made. Probably some of it had to do with all the Gershwin music, because it's a Gershwin grab bag musical. It wasn't based on a Broadway play, that Broadway musical that Gershwin had written. Irving Berlin has Alexander's Ragtime Band and others, where it's like, let's find a whole bunch of this composer's songs and put them in a musical. And that's kind of what they did with American in Paris. But it's Gershwin, so you got to love that.
And you have art. You have, yes, Toulouse-Lautrec. You have Dufay. You have Rousseau. You have Van Gogh. You have Auguste Renoir. So you have the 17-minute ballet. I mean, that puts it on a level above, for me, above Singing in the Rain. But Singing in the Rain has its own 17-minute ballet. It's just a tour through Hollywood and vaudeville versus a tour through fine art.
Yeah. I mean, this is not the 40s style, hey kids, I've got a barn, let's put on a show. This is, hey, we're in a foreign country, I've got an art museum and a priceless collection. This is kind of a scaling up.
Right.
And it's just, I don't know, it's like Singing in the Rain is just fun. You know, this has fun things in it, but it's also got, you know, the deeply tragic romance, and it's got a serious ballet to finish off.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this movie the plot is fairly inconsequential, actually. Oh,
yes.
There's a love story. Oh, yeah. But it's all about the music and the dancing and the sets and especially when you get to the ballet, which is very close to the end. So I think we'll save any deep analysis of that toward the end, because for some reason, like, there's most of a movie, there's three quarters of a movie, then there's 17 minutes of ballet, and then there's let's resolve the love story. Did we forget to do that?
Yeah,
it's like, oh yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Apparently, Arthur Freed fell in love with the piece at the time, and said, "I want to do a show that ends with an American in Paris." And this is when Gershwin was still alive. And he said, well, if you want to do that, you have to buy my entire catalog. I'm not selling you one classic piece here. And so he did. He bought the whole catalog. And then he spent a couple of decades trying to get to the point where he could make this movie. So it was kind of a passion project.
Did he buy the catalog from, was George still alive or did he buy it from Ira? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
No, that George was still alive.
George died in 37, something
I see. Yeah. Okay. Well, the other thing I was going to say is I saw the Broadway musical, and the Broadway musical is one of the best Broadway shows I've ever seen. I will put it in my top five of Broadway shows, but they actually give it a plot.
Yes.
So this is very lighthearted, and we're just sort of cruising along, and that's got lots of serious love triangle, Nazis, hiding Liesl because she was Jewish, that sort of thing in it. So it's really got more of a book than I would say this one does.
And it's interesting, they tried to do it a few years before the Broadway musical. They did a version with a book by Ken Ludwig, who's mostly known for the bedroom farce Lend Me a Tenor, which is a good, fun show. But I would never go, hey, let's get Ken Ludwig to do this. And that one really didn't go anywhere. Then they tried again, but they got Craig Lucas, who is most famous for Prelude to a Kiss. And I'm trying to remember what else he's done. He's done a couple of things and the books for a couple of musicals. And so it is a much more serious take on it. I mean, that was the whole point. It was like, oh, the wacky comedy didn't work. We need to go back and like take this show seriously. And it's, you know, it is filled with some beautiful love songs and songs like Our Love Is Here to Stay, which was not a hit until this. You know, we think of it as a standard. It's because of this movie. You know,
I think the songs are better than the love story. I think that it would have been a nice touch to, I mean, the seriousness, adding the Nazis and that sort of thing, that gives you some context for the love triangle. And I think it would make you feel for the Leslie Caron character more, because she's just a vessel for Gene Kelly to have lust and then have love with. And there's this love triangle, but there's really no substance to her character or to the triangle itself. And if you had time for her backstory, or if you'd made time for her backstory, I think it would have been far more interesting.
Well, and I think if she had been older, because she was 17 when Gene Kelly discovered her in Paris, and then they started filming the movie, I think, when she was 19, she had no acting experience. She was a trained ballerina, and she was also apparently nutritionally deprived during World War II, which was very hard on a lot of people, and she didn't have the stamina to do very much. So they had to sort of schedule her dance numbers and scenes, and then she had to have a few days off to recover from it. So I think if she had been a little older, a little more experienced as an actress, they probably could have done more with her, but they you know, just had to save her for the dance numbers.
That's so interesting. I had not heard that. I knew this was her first film and she's very inexperienced. This gives me the opportunity to jump into my usual judgmental conversation about ages of actors. Gene Kelly is in his late 30s. She's billed as being 20, I guess when this was released, when she made it, she was probably 19. And Nina Foch, who is sort of the heavy on the Gene Kelly side of the love triangle, she's 27. I mean, come on. She gives 35, but she's 27.
I was thinking if you cast it today, you could put Hannah Waddingham from Ted Lasso in the Nina Foch part. And Hannah Waddingham is 49. But I don't think Nina Foch looks that much younger than Hannah Waddingham. So wouldn't she be great? And they could build that part up a little bit more. And I think she could swan around in all the clothes that Nina Foch wears in the movie. So that's my dream casting at some point. If they were to do a remake of Singing in the Rain as a musical, I would drop her in as the Nina Foch character.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what it was we were watching, but it was a thing where I kind of looked up like, how old is that actor? He's 33. Oh, that's got to be a lot of makeup. No, he's just really aged. Like, they aged hard back then. But of course, you know, they're wearing lead and asbestos and smoking all the time.
Right.
So.
Right.
And my hot take is I actually like the Nina Foch character. And so I like the idea that whether she is an older actor or whether they just give her different things to do, I wanted to see more of her. I thought she was interesting. Yeah. And, you know, of course, we get the whole double standard of, you know, God forbid a man should openly have a commercial relationship that leads to love with a woman. But that's almost expected in the reverse. So... and Gene Kelly, who's like, you know, a starving artist, has all sorts of pride when it comes to taking things from the Nina Foch character. And she's a couple of the contemporary reviews don't like her character at all. They don't criticize the acting. They mostly don't comment on Nina Foch's acting. They mostly save their opinions about Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron and give Gene Kelly a lot of credit. And Leslie Caron is like, oh, it's her first movie. That's nice. And she's a good dancer. But when they talk about Nina Foch's character, it's mostly about how unpleasant they think the character is. She does have one scene where she's kind of a jerk to Gene Kelly, but for the most part, she's fairly straightforward, and I enjoy watching her.
So in the stage play or the stage musical, she and I want to say Max because her character reminds me of the Baroness in Sound of Music. And I know it's not Max, but she's got a friend that they create for the stage musical and they have numbers of their own. And essentially she is not only bankrolling him as a painter, but he decides he wants to open a nightclub and she bankrolls that. And so she and the Max character have their own, you know, kind of repartee about that. And then she very willingly invests so that Jerry can become more successful, which of course makes the backdoor romance with Liesl, with the Leslie Caron character, even, you know, a little bit more rocky because he really needs to be loyal to, you know, the lady that brung him, and yet he's in love with this young woman.
I think the setup of this movie is interesting because I hadn't seen it in a really long time. And so he's an artist who is not successful. He's been in World War II and he stayed on in Paris to pursue his love of painting. And I remember thinking in the very early scenes that whatever success Gene Kelly has later in the movie at convincing you that he's either a lover or somebody who makes things happen or a great dancer or whatever, I sort of don't believe him when he says, I've dreamed all my life of painting. It just doesn't, I don't know. He just doesn't seem like an artist, whatever. But they do a great job of making him, because I know there are plenty of movies where this is the kind of a character Fred Astaire would play. Hear me out. In that he's dropped into this place like Paris or London, and he's an American who's doing whatever Americans do. In Fred Astaire's case, it's usually promoting something or having some sort of con game or whatever, or being a nightclub manager or whatever.
Or just dancing.
Or just dancing, yeah. But
he usually
has some thinly veiled reason to be there. And it feels like in the beginning that they're setting the Gene Kelly character up for that sort of thing. He's friends with all of his neighbors and the little kids and everything. And so we see that he's a good guy and all that stuff. And it turns out that he's a painter, so he's a creative. And that's the part I kind of don't believe as we get to, and it's so, he's very middle America too. He's very like, very metro friendly. And in the way that I guess all actors in that era would have had to be. But I just remember, you know, he doesn't seem very bohemian or cosmopolitan. He hasn't gone native in the sort of way that you might expect somebody who had been in Paris for, you know, 5 or 6 years or whatever.
It's the hat. The hat makes him bohemian. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And also the way he dresses, definitely. That's the other thing. Yeah. One of the many interesting differentiations between, you know, people will always say Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, and they will compare them. Gene Kelly is almost always dressed much more casually. They're both very intentional about the way they appear, but Gene Kelly is much more comfortable and effortless in clothing that is far more casual. And it's not just that Fred Astaire wears a lot of evening coats, but Gene Kelly is just so intentional and athletic and physical in a way that's very different than Fred Astaire and super interesting to watch, which is probably why there is a Gene Kelly's butt temp.
Well, and also, you know, the men of that era, you know, that sort of post-war back home in America, backyard dad kind of dress. My dad wore khakis. My dad wore those penguin shirts, you know, the Munsingwear, I think they're called. And then he had like a jacket, like a golf jacket that he wore. And, you know, this is, except for the baseball cap, this is exactly how Gene Kelly is dressing. He's dressing like men in in America were dressing. And I'm not sure that men in Paris were walking around in khakis and loafers and rolled up sleeves. I think, Adam, I think, wears a suit. And Georges mm-hmm. Guitaret wears a suit.
Very much so.
Where just French. That is to set him apart.
Right, but that's right. That's why it's one reason it's so noticeable. And also, unlike when Fred Astaire plays a guy who's down on his luck and still manages to have a tuxedo, Gene Kelly at least probably dresses somewhat appropriately for his financial station.
Sure. Well, and it's always fascinating to me to watch Fred Astaire, especially at, early on, where it's top hat. He's down on his luck, but he's got a tuxedo. And Shall We Dance? He's a Russian ballet guy who really likes jazz. So he's, again, high and elegant and everything. My mother always wanted to see him play Lord Peter Wimsey. She was like, he's got that sort of patrician feeling to him, but he's a little down to earth too. And even in a movie like Swing Time, which at the time was kind of, oh my gosh, Fred's character is actually not rich or famous or elite. He's just a dance teacher named Lucky, and even there, he's just very elegant and, gliding through everything. And Gene is always down to earth, right? You feel like you could just hang out with Gene and he would run around like a monkey all over your backyard. But Fred, you would go and see at a nightclub, right? It was always...
Well, and Gene Kelly's got that, like I say, it's that physicality. And even to wearing short sleeves so that you can see his muscular arms.
See his guns.
Yeah, I know, right?
And
he's just... He's got
a gun show.
Yeah, baby.
Not just the butt. He's got the guns.
He's got that physicality. And even, I think Fred Astaire could absolutely, and often does, dance by himself and look perfectly elegant. But he also seems more at home with a partner. Gene Kelly, I mean, he can dance with Leslie Caron, but he seems more at home to me when he's dancing by himself or when he's leading whatever dancing is going on. And not with a partner. Like, he can dance in a group, certainly, and lead that group. But it feels like what Fred does seems to be, Ginger Rogers is dancing, is doing what Fred's doing, but backwards in high heels and the whole thing. But she's also an adornment to what he's doing. And Gene Kelly feels like he's creating his own space and just being very physical and very, jumping around like a monkey, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, he's great with a cartoon mouse.
Yes.
He's great in the movie The Pirate, which I do not like. Even
Makoko
though it's
the Pirate.
Oh, the Pirate. The
Black Makoko. Oh my God. Yes.
But he's fun in that.
But you get but to see Gene. You get to see Gene Kelly's thighs. In
yes,
that.
You do. Yes,
and he's
do.
Swinging and sliding and zip lining and, yep. and Judy Garland is also present, but Gene. He makes that his own. Even in For Me and My Gal, which was pretty early for him, I think that's the one with the building under construction where he's just bouncing and running and just gymnastically taking over this kind of insane set.
But that's not all he's doing. He's a very good actor, and he gets, by the time he does An American in Paris, he's really got a lot of acting chops. I believe... whatever the thinness of the love story in this movie, I believe that he's in love with Leslie Caron as much as we can believe that that's true in the few scenes that we see of them together. And he's just, in general, a good actor. There's something that makes your heart go out to him in some parts. There are parts of this movie, it's more apparent in other movies, where you just, there's some sadness, there's some pathos going on, even when he's jumping around like a crazy person. And then also, we were talking earlier about the sort of 40s movies that are, let's put on a show, we've got a barn. Actually, the movie that arguably closes that era for me is Summer Stock, which is one of my favorite movies that he's in. He and Garland together. And he is both doing all of the things that Gene Kelly does. He's literally a guy putting on a show in a barn. He's a leader of a professional acting troupe. And Judy Garland is a farmer who has a barn. And Gene Kelly would like to borrow that barn. And Judy Garland is not so sure about that. Of course, it all works out fine. But
ma'am, I got a whole bunch of kids.
And Judy Garland is on a tractor. Anyway, love Summer Stock. But he's closing. He's sort of crossing that bridge between the 40s movies and the 50s movies in a way that I find really appealing.
Well, and I think it was very interesting how in this movie, Paris is a character as well, since mm-hmm. we have an American, Gene Kelly, in yep. Paris. And we were talking about It Happened on Fifth Avenue and that there weren't very many sets. And this has lots of sets and they're all over Paris. And it's interesting that none of them are actually in Paris. It was all recreated. It's all sets. But they make wonderful use of Paris as at locations as a city.
Yeah, talk about some of those scenes, because they're simple scenes. It's not like we're showing the Arc de Triomphe or some of the more famous, or the Eiffel Tower, or some of the more famous sights of Paris. It's recognizable as Paris, but it's very much small, more mm-hmm. scenes, sidewalk cafes and outside of apartment buildings and street scenes and that sort of thing.
The opening of the movie, which is narrated by Oscar Levant, where the camera pans up from the ground floor where the cafe is, and then up a level, and then there's Oscar, and then Gene Kelly is up on top, and he's sleeping in this sort of bed on a rope or whatever. And you know, it's all beautifully choreographed, that breakfast scene at the beginning of the movie with a little bit of Gershwin music under it. And that gives you immediately the sense of place from the ground floor with the restaurant to a couple of levels of tenants and then up to his, I guess it's a chambre de bonne up at the top, sort of a maid's quarter type of thing. And I love that because immediately you know where you are. And then mm-hmm. you see the street scene where he dances with the kids. I got rhythm. And then you see Georges Guttaret, who comes in his big fancy car to join Adam for coffee. You know, and so it's just sort of like, if you didn't know it was a set, you would believe you were in Paris. And that was just a marvelous job that they did.
And I got to say, one of my favorite things in this movie, and probably one of the reasons that I love it so much compared to some of the MGMs, is Oscar Levant. You know, you've got the American, Gene Kelly, you've got Paris. Oscar Levant is just in, right? That's his character. He's just in. And he's fun because he adds an acerbic, you know, it's not just, hey, we're in Paris, this is so romantic. He's like, yeah, but it still kind of sucks because life sucks, right?
Well, he was also friends with Gershwin. That helps to know,
yes,
too.
That helps
and
too.
He's such an Eeyore, you know.
Yeah.
That's his character. But you know that scene where later in the movie where he plays the concerto in F, and he's everyone in the orchestra.
I know, and it's so good.
That is so delightful. Yeah. It's a movie that really gives a sense of the interior lives of these characters. Mm-hmm. You know, even just very simply in these little set pieces and these little fantasies. But oh my gosh, Oscar playing the whole orchestra is fantastic. And it isn't the whole concerto in F, but I still remember vividly when I was really young, we watched Perry Mason reruns at noon on weekdays before I went to school, before I started school. This is how long I remember it. And so the Perry Mason theme, the what is it, the Fifth Avenue something by Fred Steiner, that has just been burned in my head since childhood. And the first time I watched this, there is a little fragment in the concerto in F in that sequence. It's kind of a motif in the whole piece, but it's in the sequence of the movie. And I'm like, oh my God, Fred Steiner lifted that from Gershwin.
Very possibly. Yeah.
That's why it's so good. And I tried that on Terry Teachout several years ago because I'm like, all right, you know jazz. Yeah. And he listened to it and he's like, oh my God, I think you might be right. And I was like, ooh, yeah, okay.
What's nice about that scene, and there are several places in the movie where if you had a brutal editing, a brutal pair of scissors, you could cut things out. And you could certainly have cut that out. Obviously, you could shorten the ballet at the end if you wanted to. But what's nice about those scenes is they are left in. And the movie is not set up as I think about parallels to other movies. We can talk about Singing in the Rain. Another one there's a slight parallel to for me is On the Town, which is three guys and eventually they're girls. I love that opening number so much. But that these three guys do not have equal billing or place in the movie by any means. It's absolutely Gene Kelly's movie. But the other two guys, Georges Guitry and Oscar Levant, have interesting, important roles, and they get to have numbers and they get to do things that are separate from what Gene Kelly is doing. And so they form a kind of a loose trio, but they're not tied to each other in the way that they have to have like a number that they're all three doing together. In fact, I think there are combinations of the two of them, but you don't ever see the three of them dancing together.
Isn't by Strauss? Aren't they all in that number at the beginning of the movie?
I'm forgetting.
Seems like Georges comes for Georges, or what's his name in the movie?
Yeah.
Comes for coffee.
Henri
comes for coffee with Adam, and then Jerry comes down and says, "Can you loan me 200 francs?" And he said, "I don't have 200 francs." And then Henri says, "Well, let me loan it to you." And then he loans him the 200 francs. But then we get to see Gene Kelly as a nice guy dancing with the old lady and dancing with the proprietress and that sort of thing. So that's a scene. And then I think it's wonderful might be the three of them as well.
Well, Oscar is in it, but I think Oscar is doing the bit with the cigarettes and the coffee and stuff because he's the love. Yeah. He's just figured out about the love triangle. He's figured out that Gene and Georges are involved with the same woman. And instead of telling his friends, he's like, whoa, this is a problem. And then they go to do the number and he watches and he fades in the background at some point. I mean, they're all there. But
the three of them do by Strauss.
Okay. Then I'm wrong.
Because Oscar's playing the piano. And Gene Kelly's dancing with people, and Georges is being charming, I guess. Yeah.
Which is he does a lot of, and you like Georges. I like Georges a lot in this movie. He was in a number. There's somewhere it says that this is his first movie. It is not.
Not his first movie. Yeah.
There are many other movies that are probably of French extraction, and he doesn't go on to make a lot of American movies. After this, in fact, some of the reviews say, wow, he's great. He should do more stuff. And I agree. I really enjoyed him.
Yeah.
And also, I have one little trivia thing for Georges. The Stairway to Paradise number in the nightclub, apparently, you know, because he was supposed to step on each step and it lights up and then he hits the I don't know what it's called, you know, the place where he stops. And then all the steps light up. Apparently when they first did it, the steps didn't light up. Oh. And he's like banging on the steps to try to get them to light up. And they had to do a bunch of takes because they couldn't get the lights to sync with the landing. That's the phrase I was listening for. And he stands on the landing and then whoop, they all light up. Well, it wouldn't work when they first tried it. And they had to do a whole bunch of takes until they could sync, the electricians could sync the lights with the song.
And it's such a delightful set and set piece. And I can just see him going, "Have you tried turning it off and turning it on again?
Well,
have you tried kicking it?"
It's an example of how the movie is sort of having different cakes and eating them too, because that scene, you know, there's a guy in evening clothes in a nightclub doing a number. Most of the movie is not that. And the movie says, "I don't care. Let's stop and give Georges a number and let's put him in a very different situation than, I mean, he's a nightclub performer. That's what he does. So obviously that's where he is. But the movie gets to say, we're going to just mix a bunch of styles and they're all going to flow together because we're all in Paris, but we're not going to be constrained by having all of our characters wear the same clothing or be in the same settings. I didn't count the number of sets in this movie, but there are a lot. You don't go back to the same set very often.
Yeah. And also that one set that they build for the dance along the Seine, I mean, that looks exactly like a cave looks
in Paris.
I
love the stairs, those steps.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that could be Paris. They did just a remarkable job with that. And if you think about Funny Face, which is another one of my very favorite movies, which comes out in 1957, all of that was shot in Paris and in New York City. So you have the actual comparison of what was done in an American in Paris with actual Paris, and they did a great job.
Well, and it is interesting that they do take that, you know, here we're going to see the struggling artist. We're going to see the fancy art. We're going to see the nightclub. We're going to see the Seine. We're going to see all these just different aspects of Paris.
The perfume store.
The perfume store. And, you know, it it could be played as, yeah, we're just going to hit tropes, we're just going to do stereotypes, but they don't come off that way.
No.
It's kind of charming.
And I was going to say, the first bottle of perfume I ever bought on my very first trip to Paris when I was 16 was in a perfumery that looked almost exactly like the one in
nice.
The movie. So they really did their homework.
But again, I think one of the reasons it doesn't say, okay, Paris, tourist, tropes, postcards, that sort of thing, is because even though they have things like the Seine that are recognizable, we don't have a big production number in front of the Eiffel Tower.
No.
We don't feel
right.
like we have to go to Notre
right.
Dame. You know those things exist in this world. You believe that they exist. But a lot of what you see from the beginning of the movie, because we have this sort of narrative structure where they're saying, this is this guy, this is where he lives, this is the kind of life he has. He's a citizen of Paris. He happens to be an American,
yeah.
but he is now a resident of Paris, not just somebody coming over to Paris to dance in front of the Eiffel Tower. And that's apparent not only in the way they introduce the movie narratively, but in the visuals. Well, let's talk a little bit about Leslie Caron. What do you guys think of her now, given that she's very young, as we said, and given that this is her first film and all that stuff? I have sort of mixed feelings, because I think she, to me, like, she sort of handles the duality of the life she's trying to live in the way that a young person might. I guess and she's a good dancer, and she feels like she's just not seasoned as an actor yet.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a reason why we focus a lot on Henri and Adam and Nina Foch. And it's, you know, she exists as a muse. She exists as someone for Jean to be occupied by. But I don't entirely buy it. I don't. And you know, if she had like two or three more years and a little more experience, maybe maybe she'd have more weight. Maybe she'd hold the screen better with him.
Or better writing. I mean,
absolutely.
It's really not her fault. I don't blame her at all.
I don't think it was her absolute first movie, but it was her first Hollywood movie. And I don't think they expected very much of her except as a dancing partner for Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
When he needed to show he was attractive to women, although we obviously know he's attractive to everybody, not
right.
just women. But I think a better actress, but you know, who would do it? You would need a French actress if you're going to have her be French. We would have some notable French actresses another decade later. You would have Catherine Deneuve, you would have Jane Birkin, Jane Birkin could play French if she had to. I mean, there would have been other people to cast in it in a few more years, but they didn't have what they were looking for. And Gene Kelly wanted a ballerina. He wanted someone who could dance.
Yeah.
He specifically went and auditioned people and found her. So then you work around her weaknesses, which at that moment was acting, although she became a fine actress much later.
And I guess the best thing I can say about it is that they were smart not to overuse her and force her into doing things she couldn't do. And so it makes the plot very thin, and it makes the love stuff between her and Gene Kelly somewhat unbelievable or unfinished. But for the actor, like, you can't watch her performance and go, well, this is a bad thing she did, or she made the film less than it would otherwise have been, because they were just smart not to overuse her.
You see the promise there. And I mean, really the main reason she's there is to dance well in the American in Paris portion of the film.
Right.
And the rest of it, you just need to get her across the finish line to that part of the movie. And then it's golden. Then you buy it.
So there's a funny story in her autobiography, which I read, which is that they were trying to make her look like a Hollywood babe with her hair. And she kept saying to Arthur Freed, no, Parisian women are not wearing, you know, big hair. We're wearing these gamine kind of haircuts. And he just didn't want that for the movie. So she cut her own hair. She basically chopped, which, you know, Gene Kelly told her they could fire you for that. But she chopped off her hair and she wanted a pixie cut. And they made her wait 3 weeks for her hair to grow back enough so that it satisfied the look that they wanted for the movie, which I think is actually kind of cool. I mean, if you think about Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday going and getting a haircut, I guess, and this is like 2 years before Roman Holiday. So there was Leslie Caron kind of asserting her independence and trying to be French, and them saying, no, we don't want you to be that French.
The way it comes out, I kind of like. I mean, would it have been better if she had had it in the pixie style that she originally wanted? Perhaps, but I don't think it's unattractive. I think it's interesting the way they choose to costume her, because except for that gown for the last scene, she's in sort of, I can't figure out her clothes, actually. The first outdress she wears when we meet her is kind of a schoolmarmy sort of thing.
Yeah, I think she's in just sort of shop girl, working girl kinds of clothes. Because she's not, I mean, there's no money. I mean, she's working in the selling perfume and then depends on Henri and his family for support, you know, because they took care of her during the war or whatever. She doesn't have a lot of disposable income, and she's not married to Henri yet, so she doesn't have the ability to tap into whatever fortune he has. So she looks like a basic French working girl after World War II.
That's fair. And I think, too, that it goes along, it's of a piece with not needlessly or inappropriately glamorizing people in the movie who do not have means, Gene Kelly included, and certainly her included, and all those kids and all the things that there's nobody who dresses in a way that I see and go, that doesn't make any sense. The people who look nice, who are well turned out, are people who should be that way, either because of what they do for a living or because they have the means to do it. Well, let's see what else. We talked about Nina Foch. Okay, Georges Guettari. Let's talk about him, because I heard before the show that some of you might have some thoughts on Mr. Guettari's acting and his performance, and may even have some interpretations to offer of same.
Again, this is of all the niche impressions I can do, and let's not even get started there. This is maybe the nichiest, probably because I've seen it so many times. And of course, when you find voices that are in your range and in your timbre, you go, ooh, I want to try that. And then you try it out, and either it's like, oh, no, that was a mistake. Or you go, zoinks, I can do Shaggy. Right, it's
and
like
you dine out on it for years.
Yeah, there's no middle ground. There's no I'll work on this. No, it's either you can do it or it's really painful. And somewhere along the line, I had the song in my head, and normally, again, I've lived with songs in my head all my life, and Porter and Gershwin and Kern and all of them, and normally I just sing as myself, and for some reason, I'm walking along and it just came out, I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. It's like, what is going on? And my mother came in like, are you watching that really loud? I went, no, it's not on. That, here, watch this. I'm going to get there at any price. Stand aside, I'm on my way. And she's like, oh no.
And it is a good number. It's at least it isn't an earworm that you're sad to have in your head. It's an excellent number. And it kind of took me by surprise. And I'd seen this before, but a really long time. And that number kind of takes you by surprise, because it's like, oh, wow, here is a relatively minor character in the story. We've heard him sing. We know he can sing. But he's got this old number all to himself. It's well produced. It's they take their time with it. It's just lovely. And David can pretend to be him.
It's charming. And, you know, it sort of gets across that, hey, there's a bunch of showgirls. Hey, it's kind of sexy. But it's not too risque. It's not over.
It's not a Felice Bergère kind of thing.
You know, not at all. And, you know, 8 years later, they made a film of Cole Porter's Can Can, which has some good songs in the Broadway version. Not top tier porter, but hey, near the end. But the movie, if we ever do a rocket surgery edition of Lions, Towers, and Shields,
might.
We should do Can-Can because, oh, it's terrible. And one of my favorite things in 50s musicals is Frank Sinatra being pissed because Guys and Dolls,
oh yeah,
the whole movie, he is seething because he wants to be Sky Masterson.
Right, right.
And it's hilarious. Yeah. And he is seething all through Can-Can because he was forced to make it because he had walked off the set of Carousel. He was supposed to be in Carousel, and 20th Century Fox held him to it. And it's like, you're going to make a movie for us, and I don't care what it is. So it's almost like they said, hey, let's make a really bad movie musical, and we'll force Frank to be in it. Oh, it is awful. But you know, you have you do at least have Louis Jourdan and Maurice Chevalier, who are actually French, but oh, it's a terrible movie. It hits all of the bad versions of those tropes.
Well, he was in a really bad avoided. Version of Pal Joey also.
Yes.
He was terrible. That's a terrible movie. And the sad thing about it is what
made Gene Kelly
a star. And Frank Sinatra could play him, then Gene certainly could have played him, although it was 1957, and I think Gene had other things that he was working on at the time. But
yeah.
Gosh, I wish they had just left Gene Kelly in that movie because he's the right person for Joey. And Frank Sinatra was just wrong, wrong, wrong.
I just feel like musicals, Frank Sinatra's singing notwithstanding, it feels like musicals would require Frank to work a lot harder than he would want to work. That's the impression I always get of that guy. Yeah.
I love how Nathan Detroit does not have a lot of songs in Guys and Dolls. He's only got Sue Me. Everything else, he's just sort of hanging out while other people are singing. And they just shoehorn Frank into all these songs, and it doesn't work.
Right.
Oh
well, from bad anyway. Back to good. Shall we talk about the ballet? So we have 17 minutes ballet, which is basically impressionist French painters set to music and dance. And Gene Kelly, who choreographed this whole movie, won a special Oscar for his choreography. And certainly this ballet is the main reason that happened. And they spent like almost $500,000 to just do this segment. So it's kind of amazing. In 1951 that happened, because remember, in 1951, I don't know the exact economic situation for MGM, but it's after the 1949 antitrust stuff that busted up the studio's distribution hubs. And so the television was also a coming thing. So the studios were not exactly flush in 1951, but somehow they got to spend Vincente Minnelli got to spend $450,000 to make this 17-minute ballet with Gene choreographing it.
Well, and that was part of what freed was taking so long to make the film, was that nobody believed that this was going to work. And they tried to talk him out of it even at the time. They're like, you can't end the movie like that.
And he basically said, if I don't get to do the ballet, then, you know.
Right.
Well, and I believe they did it after the rest. So Minnelli shot most of the movie, and he went off to shoot the delightful Father's Little Dividend, which is a sequel to Father of the Bride. And then he came back and he made this ballet.
Well, they needed it because apparently it took 6 weeks to build the sets, the backdrops, and get everything ready and train the dancers and all that for the movie.
I mean, it is tremendous.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
But yeah, Freed had to do a lot of talking to get them to give them the money to do it in the first place.
Well, and you know, Barbie, the reason that there's a Ken dance scene, fantasy dance ballet in Barbie, is that Greta Gerwig loves An American in Paris. And she said, I want a ballet. And they're basically like, why do you want a ballet? And she said, because I want a ballet. And that's how the whole I'm just Ken number, you know, can you feel my Kenergy, how that all got started, because she
I'd
loves
like
this
to introduce
movie.
My third panelist, Greta Gerwig. Welcome to the show. No. Lovely.
Marshall McLuhan pops up from behind a tree.
What's interesting about the ballet to me is I am not as educated as I ought to be in the painters that they are referencing. I mean, I know enough to know that it's happening, and I know enough to have read which ones are which. Mm-hmm. But I kind of wonder, if you're the general public and you've just come to see a movie musical, like how this sort of out of body experience of this ballet, which changes sets constantly and costumes and the like. I just wonder how it hits somebody who is expecting an I've Got Rhythm sort of musical.
I mean, you have to look them all up. I mean, I recognize Toulouse-Lautrec, and I recognize Van Gogh and Renoir, but you know, I had to look up the other painters to just be sure of what I was seeing. And I don't know. I mean, Americans in 1951, went to museums. The Impressionists were certainly popular, but there might have had to be an education level to really understand what this all was.
Yeah, I mean, as a child, it just sort of washed over me, and I just liked it because it was pretty and it was attractive and the music was cool and the dancing was neat. Yeah. And there were a couple of things that I recognized. Like, we had some Renoir prints and Van Gogh prints in the doll museum, and so I would recognize things. I knew Blue Boy. I knew the I'm trying to think of the other one.
Pinky
and Blue Boy.
We had Pinky in over my mother's desk, and we had sunflowers in the bathroom. So
that's fancy. Wow.
We had several dolls that were either had at the time been made to look like the paintings, and then we had to make outfits that looked plausible to go with them. But we had those, you know, sprinkled through the museum. And so I did recognize some things even then, but mostly it was just, hey, this is cool.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of what I was getting at. Not so much that you have to have that art literacy to understand it, but just how somebody who didn't, who wasn't expecting it, or who didn't know about art generally, would sort of take it, because it is multiple dances within one setting, and the music changes and the costumes change and who's doing what changes. And that's not something people would have been unfamiliar with. I mean, that goes back as far as Busby Berkeley, but this is so much of it, so long. And I think what makes it work is just the beauty of the setting and how many different things are going on, and you know, the charisma of Gene Kelly and his butt, frankly.
So Patricia Ward Kelly, who is his widow, who was much younger than Gene, but love very, very much caring, you know, carrying the flag for Gene. She posted a photo of him dressed as Chocolat, the jockey, and said, you know, notice that he's down in a crouch. And she, I think, was swirling her leg over him, you know, doing the can-can over him or whatever. And she's like, look at the strength in those thighs. yes. But her point was that most male dancers, their strength is in their upper body because they're holding up their partners. You know, if you look at Mikhail Baryshnikov, you know, he had guns, he had a developed chest. But Gene's strength was lower body, which gave him all of the stamina to do all of the dance numbers. So next time you look at Gene Kelly's butt, look at the thighs too.
Look at the delts, look at the quads.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, and again, the way he dresses not only makes it easier for him to move, although I assume whatever a dancer is wearing, whatever it may look like, the way it's cut internally may not be apparent to the audience, but the way he's dressed certainly is that jockey, but even in khakis and all the other things that he wears in those numbers definitely sort of accentuate the way his legs move and the degree to which he can spread his legs and lift them and just, you know, do things that, you know, Fred Astaire's swirling around and stuff, but Gene Kelly is like really going hard with his lower body.
Well, and the costume department on many of the films when he was at MGM actually fashioned very ordinary looking shoes that were really dance shoes, whether they were tap or ballet shoes, but they were designed to look as ordinary as possible.
Yeah, because that was part of it. Like he's doing that everyman thing, whatever part he's playing. There's something of the everyman down to earth guy in what he does, and that's reflected in his clothing and in his movements. I mean, maybe not every man can move quite the way he does, but he's moving more like every man than Fred Astaire might be.
I can do that every day.
I'm sure you can.
Yes.
You can sing like George and you can dance like Gene. You are multi-talented.
No, there's a little parallel between Dancing in the Dark in The Bandwagon, which is, I think, an underappreciated movie. I love The Bandwagon.
I love The Bandwagon.
Yeah.
So much.
And
all right, so we're Dancing have to do it then.
yes,
absolutely. Are you kidding?
Yep, we'll do it.
I'll go my way by myself. Anyway, I guess I have to sing all the numbers in these movies. But anyway, so you have Dancing in the Dark, which is truly like a bridge to the romance in The Bandwagon. And then you have Our Love is Here to Stay, where they dance on the quay next to the Seine. And that's the bridge from her sort of fighting Jerry off to realizing that, yeah, he might be kind of attractive here. So, I was just going to draw the parallel between those two. I know I got away from the ballet for a second. But if you don't have them dancing by the Seine, you're not going to see the connection between the two of them in the big ballet.
Right. Right.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and it's the kind of thing that Fred used to call the mood dance, right? There was always one number in his films where that was the seduction. It was, and there was nothing subtextual about it. It's like, yeah, we're dancing, but it's the seduction. And it's where the attitude of Ginger will change, or the attitude of Sid Charisse will change, or whomever his partner is. And that's where you see that connection. Like, no matter what his profession or Gene's profession is, it's in the dance that they make the seduction. And it's in the dance where the two leads connect as human beings and go, oh yes, you're the other one. Come here. Yes, let's do this.
You're mine. I like you, even though I've been telling you for 20 minutes that I don't like you. I do like you now.
And what's interesting is Gene's movies don't always have that. And this is one that does, and it really works. It does a lot of that heavy lifting in the romance part.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about Singing in the Rain, you know, they've established the romance between Debbie Reynolds and Gene, and then there are obstacles, and then... What's the matter with the way I talk? Gene, what is her last name?
Gene Hagen.
Gene Hagen, yeah. Basically, you know, throws her off the set, and then Donald O'Connor and Gene conspire to lift the curtain, and we can see that Debbie Reynolds was talking and singing for her, and then Debbie Reynolds goes running out of the theater, and they yell, "Stop! Stop!" You know, and then they're reunited, and it's kind of like in this movie. Leslie Caron has gotten in the car to go to the airport to Orly or wherever she was going with him to leave. And then the car comes back and she gets out of the car and runs up the stairs at Montmartre to alleged Montmartre to meet him. And he runs down the stairs and they have their reunion.
And I was thinking to myself, what shoes is she wearing? Because she's got to run up and he's got to run down. And wow.
And that's a long staircase, I can tell you that.
So. I bet.
Yeah.
And it didn't light up.
No, it didn't light up.
What fun is that?
That was a good fake. Oh, so apparently they built something like 30 sets of Paris, but that one was the one I think they got the closest to looking like Paris, because there is a staircase very much like that. You can either take a little rail car up it or you can walk up it. And that's exactly what it looks like.
Well done. So people who, that's the nice tell about it though. So people who know Paris would know that without having to see the most tropey of Paris symbols. You're like, oh yeah, that feels like Paris to me. And so it's probably more effective for somebody who is world-wise and knows Paris and is like, oh God, another picture of the same things we always see, the postcard pictures. Right. So yeah, they made good choices. What else do we want to say about American Paris before we wrap up?
I don't know if Gene and the crew had seen it beforehand and if it influenced them or not. I would imagine he might have, just because, you know, when there is a movie focused on dance, someone like Gene Kelly could say, hey, I would like to get a print of that and watch it. because you have the red shoes just mm-hmm. a few years mm-hmm. earlier, which does get away with doing a lot of long dance sequences without words and you know, certainly not lyrics. It's all opera and ballet. And it would be interesting to sit up, I've never sat down with both movies and said, I want to watch them both back to back and see, because there is a certain vividness to the colors in An American in Paris that even as bright and cheery and bold as the set designs of all the other MGM films were, this one looks different to me. Maybe it's because it's trying to be Paris. I don't know. But it just has, or maybe it's because of the use of the artwork and the influence of the museum.
I feel like the attempt to be painterly yeah. is more evident, because there are plenty of other MGM musicals of various eras that are set in something that is meant to be Paris. And usually what you see is the insides of nightclubs and people with French accents. So you don't, so that they call it Paris and you're like, okay, I guess it's Paris, even though what you're seeing, you know, it's Silk Stockings is in Paris, but there's not a whole lot of Paris in Silk Stockings. We've talked about Silk Stockings before. Yes. I was surprised at how much venom
Silk Stockings is not on my top 10 list.
You know, I liked it the first few times I watched it, and I think this panel might have convinced me to like it less than I did when I started that, which I was very surprised by.
I am so sorry.
But now I'm with you and Phil Michaels, I think, together. But, we'll watch The Bandwagon, and I'll feel better.
yeah. Well, and The Bandwagon, you get Oscar Levant.
Yeah, that's true.
Oscar Levant.
Well, and Nanette Fabre is in that.
And you get Jack Buchanan.
And you get Grand Central Station. And
and Sid Charisse.
Yeah, I love you,
Sid Charisse, who was just a little bit taller than Fred. So they had to work around that a little bit.
And I think she might have been an even better partner for him.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I wonder, she was too old to play. I mean, if you want Liesl to be, you know, 19 years old, she's too old to play her, but she could have played this part.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what movies Gene and Sid were in together. It's not coming to my memory. Dave, maybe you know, but...
She's in the Gotta Dance ballet in Singin' in the Rain, but she's not any of the rest of the movies.
Right. That's why I didn't remember that.
Yeah. Slaughter on 10th Avenue is Fred, right? In the Bandwagon.
Yeah.
So I think they made something else together, though.
Almost certainly they would have, unless... Because she might be taller than Gene. I don't know. Gene's not that tall.
She's taller than
Gene. He's taller than Fred. I just love watching a tall woman dance. I think that's so cool. And she's delightful. And she wasn't always the best actor. Some movies, she's good in Bandwagon, actually. Some movies, not so much. I think that is one of the knocks on Silk Stockings. It's like she's doing that. She's in too much into the Russian accent or something, but doesn't quite work.
Oh. Brigadoon.
Brigadoon. Okay.
Not a great movie.
No. Not a great movie, but
And she's in It's Always Fair Weather.
Oh,
which
you're right.
I probably have seen, but I don't really remember it.
It's not.
It's not memorable.
It's the only thing good is the scene where they dance on lids of trash cans. That's kind of fun.
Oh, that's right. That's
the
in that.
tap dancing with trash can lid
that
scene.
Fun.
What's the one where Gene does the whole thing on roller skates?
That's in that movie too.
Is that also Fairweather?
Okay. Well, so maybe we'll have to watch it.
But you know, the best way to watch It's Always Fair Weather is just to watch That's Entertainment.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, because the good
there
stuff is in there.
Yeah, that may be true of several. I mean, like, I'm not a fan of Royal Wedding, but I enjoy that number.
And they were so mismatched, because I think he was 20 or 25 years older than Jane Powell. But, the other thing I want to mention about Singing in the Rain is that teeny tiny little cameo by Winston Churchill when he's walking up the hill at Montmartre to go set up his little stand of paintings. I just love that scene because people, if you know that Winston Churchill was a painter, you get it. And otherwise, you're just going to wonder, what is Winston Churchill doing
in my movie?
Yeah, doing in this movie. But yeah, I always thought that was a really charming little note.
Two great tastes that taste great together. Indeed. You know, he was a surprising dance partner for Gene Kelly. almost as surprising as the mouse. Almost.
Well, friends, thanks so much for joining us for An American in Paris. We'll be back next week with a very different movie, I Know Where I'm Going. If you want to follow this podcast, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can also communicate with us on the socials at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Or you can drop us an email at lts@theincomparable.com. See you next week. Bye
now. Au revoir.
I've got the blues. They're going to bury me there. Shoes, go on and carry me there.
I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.